We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Thursday, April 18th, and we are witnessing yet another tragedy in the form of the U.S. Constitution being just completely ignored, and accountability for any sort of elected official or anyone on the Democrat side in terms of accountability, just non-existent. And this, of course, coming as the Democrat-controlled Senate dismissed both articles of impeachment against Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas yesterday, and they quashed the Republican push to remove the cabinet secretary from office. So this coming from National Review, the Senate voted 51-49 along partisan lines to kill the second impeachment charge, 51-48-1, with Murkowski, I think it was, who just voted present for the first impeachment charge, and then, you know, decided to just vote for the second one. The upper chamber also voted 51-49 to end the short-lived trial, which began earlier on Wednesday. And so the DHS spokesperson said in a statement that the Senate's decision to reject the impeachment articles, quote, proves definitively that there was no evidence or constitutional grounds to justify impeachment. That's laughable, absolutely ridiculous, because we know that this was totally just along partisan political lines. And yet, what do we do when the U.S. Constitution does provide the ability, I think, textually and procedurally for the Senate to just dismiss outright as sort of a pre-trial procedural move? Because if we go back to the text, before we get into the political nature of it, the text in Article 1, 3.6, when talking about the Senate side, because the House has the sole power of impeachment, so they have to file those impeachment articles, basically the charges. And then 3.6 says, the Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments. When sitting for that purpose, they shall be on oath or affirmation. When the President of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall preside, and no person shall be convicted without the concurrence of 2/3 of the members present. So those are the only procedural requirements in the Constitution. And then the Senate can form their own process subsequent to that. I mean, it's similar to how different courtrooms across different jurisdictions have different procedural rules, as long as they're fundamentally complying with the overall law of the jurisdiction in which the court is sitting. Then, you know, there are some differences, and legal practitioners know that, you know, if you go from courtroom to courtroom, even if it's within the same courthouse and it's in the same county even, or the same state or the same federal building, different judges just have different preferences, and that's okay. But in terms of the process here, the Senate shall have sole power to try all impeachments. So this is just a forum selection or a venue selection and basically a jury selection. The Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments, but the text does not say the Senate must try or hold a trial. And so from the perspective that there is some room for process that dispenses with a trial is technically, I think, constitutional. Here, it's entirely political, and we know that. But Republicans are arguing that Article 1, Section 3.6 requires a trial, but the plain reading, as I just read to you, is the Senate has sole power to try, meaning there's no other available forum, not simply the Senate shall try. So I think Republicans would be better off arguing that dispensing with a trial or summary judgment on the articles themselves could apply, but it's an interesting use of process to have the Senate themselves, basically the jury in this instance, determining these questions of law instead of the presiding judge. In cases where the president is impeached, it's the Chief Justice. In all other cases of impeachment, it can be some other presiding officer. And typically, in a regular court process, you have a division between the jury that determines questions of fact and the judge, which determines questions of law, like whether or not a charge is legally viable, whether there are other legal reasons to dismiss or require the prosecution to bring back a defective charge. I mean, all of these other things that are readings and applications of legal questions, that is for the presiding judge to determine. And so I think we're just in a total mess with impeachment power from a procedural standpoint. And again, we'll get into the political purposes, but we need to not use impeachment, obviously, for political purposes, and it should be confined to actual impeachable offenses. But what should happen if we're just dealing with a procedural, is that legislation requiring a process for everyone, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, whether the majority of the Senate is the opposition party or the same party as the defendant, everyone should have the same process. That's part of fundamental fairness, right? And Congress could legislate under Article 1, Section 3.2, and even Congress could determine their own rules for a trial, which in large part they have, other than this sort of pretrial process. And I think Congress could require itself to try all impeachments, or they could at least provide a pretrial procedural process. Because remember, this wasn't that long ago that Donald Trump was impeached twice. And when I first started working for the former president, was in the leading up to that first impeachment. That was the purpose for which I was hired, was to be part of that that legal team. And there was this substantive question of whether we could, as a pretrial mechanism, simply ask for the Senate to dismiss the articles of impeachment, because it was our view at the time, and I think it's still accurate, that they weren't constitutionally viable. But yet we went through this whole, you know, like 2-month trial that took up everybody's attention. It took away from the business of governing, all of those things. Everybody remembers that because, oh my gosh, you know, this is the impeachment of Donald Trump. It's the biggest thing going on in the world, and he's being held accountable and all of this. But if the Senate had afforded Trump the same process that they did to Mayorkas, then we could have just dispensed with the whole thing in an afternoon like they did yesterday. But of course, that would have been predicated on whether or not the members of the Senate were Republican-controlled versus Democrat-controlled. And this is why we are in a frustrating moment in time here, because we see that process and accountability and justice itself is now purely political. So I mean, all of that commentary is great from a legal perspective, a constitutional perspective. Hopefully that gives you the insight, but it doesn't deal with the actual thrust of the issue, which is, as Copper is agreeing with me in the background, they're playing in the background, if you can hear the puppies barking. I think that he doesn't like impeachment. But the political part of this, we know, and we just feel to our bones, is so manifestly unjust. It's unfair. And meanwhile, Donald Trump is sitting in a defendant's chair for probably 6 or 8 weeks in one of the most flimsy, ridiculous cases that has ever been brought by a district attorney. So where was the process there? Where was the summary judgment for his trial? Well, of course, nowhere, because you're in a jurisdiction that is trying to hold him accountable. And it's entirely politicizing and weaponizing the justice system and all mechanisms of the constitutional process for accountability, because impeachment power being given to the House to hold executive officers and judicial officers accountable is part of our separation and balance of powers. And it's a quasi-judicial forum, and everybody argued during the Trump impeachment that, oh, this is just a political process, and it's the sole province of the House and Senate. Whatever they want to do doesn't matter. You know, all this, and I'm old enough to remember when in the second impeachment hearing, Chuck Schumer was up there saying, we have to hold a trial. It doesn't matter that Trump has already gone from office. You know, this in January 22nd of 2021. No, there will be a trial, and it doesn't matter. And the Constitution requires it. And then he's out there yesterday saying, well, no, this absolutely is constitutionally viable that we dismissed the articles against Mayorkas, because we don't want the House to be able to just take up all of the Senate's time, and we can't do our own business. That is pure nonsense. Because he's arguing both sides of the argument depending on which serves his political purpose. And that's the problem right now that we have with any of our accountability mechanisms, whether it's impeachment, it's civil justice, it's criminal justice, it's any of these embedded mechanisms to provide accountability across the board and fairly. So this completely stinks. Because if Mayorkas does not have to answer for his actions with a full trial, why should Donald Trump have had to argue? And Governor Greg Abbott from Texas posted this morning. He said, if Secretary Mayorkas will not be held accountable for refusing to follow federal law, why should any American be accountable for refusing to follow federal law? The Senate sets a double standard for Americans. You will reap what you sow. And I'm going to get into this a little later on in the program, because I had an opportunity to talk to Steve Dace last night on my Salem show. And we talked more about this and where we go from here, because it is so frustrating to live in a society where you see that it is manifestly unfair that the rules don't apply in the same way to similarly situated individuals. It just depends on what political point of view and political party you identify with. And so, and whichever party is in control. And politics should not work that way. And political parties should not have the sole opportunity when they are in a majority to dictate what justice means for their own party and for their political opposition. That is not justice. That is not accountability. That is not fairness. And that's where we are headed with all of these different facets. And so it is frustrating to see that Republicans are focused so much on the merit of their impeachment, which I've said for a long time I disagreed with going after Mayorkas, not because he didn't break federal law and he wasn't worthy of impeachment. I think that he was. But that it ultimately, even if he had been convicted and removed, it wouldn't matter. They should have been going after Joe Biden, who is the head in the administration that sets the policy that Mayorkas simply carried out. But Republicans are focusing so much, even in Speaker Johnson's response yesterday, was focusing on how, you know, this is going to be terrible for the border crisis. And all that. Sure, that's absolutely true. But you're missing the bigger point here. The bigger point was that procedural process cannot work one way for Republicans and a different way for Democrats. It can't work one way for Christians and conservatives and Trump supporters, and another way for the Democrats, the leftists, the LGBTQIA identifying people. But we're in not a procedural, fundamental due process society anymore. We are in a so-called civil rights society that gives preference, and we are in a purely political will society at this point. And it is undermining the very notions of fairness, justice, and our Constitution itself. So while I think it was textually constitutional what the Senate did, they need to establish a process that is fair for everyone. Otherwise, what are we even doing here? So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we are continuing to talk about the unprecedented dismissal pre-trial in the U.S. Senate yesterday of the two articles of impeachment against DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. And this is just a really sad day for America. And obviously, there's not going to be this sort of consensus of fairness because everything is now political and just majority will and political will. But where do we go from here? So joining me now is Congressman Bob Good, who is the chairman of the Freedom Caucus and proudly serving the 5th Congressional District of Virginia. So good morning, Congressman Good. And your reaction to the Senate, especially in light of Chuck Schumer's comments in the two impeachments of Donald Trump saying, no, we have to hold a trial. And now they just go ahead and dismiss it and not even make Mayorkas stand trial.
I'm almost beginning to think Chuck Schumer's a hypocrite, that he's inconsistent, but I'm probably mistaken. But what it does do, Jenna, is it confirms what we already know. The Democrats want the border invasion. They don't see a problem. This is the plan. These are undocumented Democrats, they believe, streaming across the border. They don't care about the 10 million pieces of evidence incriminating Mayorkas, the 10 million illegals that he has helped across our border. Every resource that he has directed to the border has been with the intention of bringing more illegals in more quickly. Some 9 million nearly now that have surrendered to Border Patrol for all the free stuff from Joe Biden, all the accommodations, and then more than 2 million known gotaways, the even more dangerous. You know, they've caught 300 on the terrorist watch list during Biden's regime these last 3 years, who were the dumb ones who figured, well, we vet so poorly, we're not serious about returning anyone who comes to the border. So the dumb ones that thought they wouldn't get caught, there's more than 300 on the terrorist watch list. How many are among the 2 million, the highly dangerous ones who pay the cartels even more to be part of the gotaway crowd instead of the surrender crowd? The cartels have made an estimated $20 billion last year off Biden's border invasion, Mayorkas' border invasion, and that's what Chuck Schumer and the Democrats apparently want.
And it's a violation of federal law and of the Constitution, and yet I don't think if the House had brought impeachment articles against President Biden himself, the outcome in the Senate would have been any different for exactly the reasons that you're articulating. So I read a tweet earlier from Greg Abbott, Governor Abbott in Texas, that said, you know, Secretary Mayorkas will not be held accountable for refusing to follow federal law. Why should any American be accountable for refusing to follow federal law? I mean, where does this get us in terms of accountability then when the Biden administration is not following the law?
And Governor Abbott knows it better than anyone else, of course, because he and his citizens are living it like no one else on the front lines, as the largest portion of the border is the Texas border. And as he and his team have tried to stand in the gap and protect their citizens and then by extension protect Americans, that's who the Biden administration goes after. That's who they try to hold accountable. They say, no, Texas, you can't do that. No, you don't have authority to implement border security or to turn back illegal aliens from invading your state. We're not going to do it. Matter of fact, we're trying to help perpetuate the invasion, and we're going to sue you, challenge you, fight you, no matter that hundreds, as we saw a couple of weeks ago, bum rush, mob rush, Texas border personnel to force their way in violently. Did that bring a reaction from the Biden administration? You know what? Maybe we've got to start to protect citizens. No, they're not, because this is a lawless administration, to your point. They don't care about the Constitution. They don't care about the law. There's not equal application of the law. Everyone is not equal under the law in this administration. It's a two-tiered justice system. It's a weaponized federal government. They're abusing their power, and Secretary Mayorkas is certainly abusing the authority that was placed in him when he was named Homeland Security, boy, Homeland Insecurity Secretary, I guess we should say.
And so this just raises the question then. I mean, we all know that to be true. And I think everyone listening right now is frustrated and outraged at what is going on in our country with this extreme lawless administration. And yet at every turn, whether it is in an impeachment context, whether it's in a judicial civil context, there's no accountability. And so it seems like they're just going to be able to get away with everything that they're doing. So what are we even doing then? What's the next step in terms of a potential strategy that Republicans can and should take? Because it seems like Speaker Johnson is just now, his attention has moved on and he's focusing on Ukraine aid.
Yeah, well, there's several things that can be done, some of which have been tried and some of them have not. Certainly, we tried with the impeachment of the Senate. You know, elections have consequences. They have the Senate. The American people gave them the Senate, and they're blunting our efforts to hold them accountable. But what we could have done in the House, and we didn't do, and I blame the Speaker and Republican, weak, moderate Republicans, rhinos who didn't help us, we could have defunded the Department of Homeland Security. We could have defunded Secretary Mayorkas. We tried to do that. The Freedom Caucus did. And we didn't get a majority in a Republican House to do that. Instead, we gave them a $3 billion raise in the omnibus that was just passed, 3 weeks ago now. We should have not been willing to fund this Department of Homeland Security that's perpetuating the invasion. We should have forced border security provisions into the spending bills. We should have forced them into this disaster of a supplemental that we're going to be voting on apparently Saturday evening that's going to defend Ukraine's border, borrow $100 billion to defend other countries' borders, pass it with predominantly Democrat votes. It should be called the American Last Bill because that's what it is.
Yeah, and it's $300 million for Ukraine and nothing for the U.S. border, and I think Republicans are rightly frustrated, and conservatives, that the one promise that but one of the biggest promises I think that Speaker Johnson made when he took the gavel was that he would not fund Ukraine without protecting America's border first. And now he has, of course, walked that back. And I want your response to this clip, Representative Good, where Johnson is talking on C-SPAN and responding to reporters why he is now, in his mind, justifying sending aid to Ukraine when he is not done anything in terms of border security yet. This is Cut 11.
I'm doing here what I believe to be the right thing. I think providing lethal aid to Ukraine right now is critically important. I really do. I really do believe the intel and the briefings that we've gotten that I believe Xi and Vladimir Putin and Iran really are an axis of evil. I think they're in coordination on this. I think that Vladimir Putin would continue to march through Europe if he were allowed. I think he might go to the Balkans next. I think he might have a showdown with Poland or one of our NATO allies. To put it bluntly, I would rather send bullets to Ukraine than American boys. My son is going to begin in the Naval Academy this fall. This is a live fire exercise for me, as it is so many American families. This is not a game. It's not a joke. We can't play politics with this. We have to do the right thing. And I'm going to allow an opportunity for every single member of the House to vote their conscience and their will on this. And I think that's the way this institution is supposed to work. And I'm willing to take personal risk for that because we have to do the right thing, and history will judge us.
Representative Good, what's your response to that?
Well, he was against Ukraine funding before he was for it. He was for visa reform to protect Americans' constitutional liberties until he became against it. In both cases, it was because he got briefs from the intelligence community, the military-industrial complex, which I guess has scared him. He was for using Ukraine, the Democrats' desire for Ukraine to secure the border. Now he's against that, and he has decided that any amendments that we make to try to force border security onto this supplemental for Ukraine will be considered not germane, meaning not relevant to the subject matter, and those amendments are not going to be allowed. And so I don't know who he's listening to. I don't know why he's listening to them. I don't know why he's changed his position on so many things, but it's certainly hurting the American people. It's hurting our national security. We don't have the $100 billion that we're borrowing to send over there. I don't believe there is a relevant American national security interest in doing so, and we certainly ought to be putting our country and our border first.
I completely agree with you, and I think that the base and every conservative would agree with you and has been very disappointed in seeing this change in priorities under the guise of the classified briefings. And it's an easy way to say, well, I have information that you don't, therefore trust me kind of defense. And if Mike Johnson came out and actually explained why, then maybe it would make sense. I mean, is there in your mind anything that could have been in a classified briefing or, you know, from the intelligence community that would justify his change in position?
Not in my view, that nothing that I'm aware of. And, you know, do I think there's merit to the view that, gosh, if we don't stop Putin here, then, you know, it'll be worse in the future. But we shouldn't be borrowing to do it, and we ought to keep our word that we said we would require the Democrats to join us in defending the United States and defending our borders to do it. There ought to be accountability and transparency. Again, I don't support aid for Ukraine. I don't believe it's our fight. This is not a democracy. This is not a NATO partner. This is a corrupt country. I don't know what the long-term victory looks like. These are going to be border countries for a long time. United States cannot be the world's policeman, cannot be the world's benefactor. That's not been demonstrated. That's been helpful to us. I think we elevate our involvement if we send, you know, billions of dollars over there. So I'm against it, but at least let's make the trade for our own national security, which is what the speaker promised to do. We've given up every leveraged point to try to force the Dems to secure the border. We gave up the spending battles. We've now given up Ukraine. There's nothing left for us to force it. And worse yet, Jenna, he's going to insult the intelligence of the American people, or try to anyway, and add this pretend phony border provision as a fifth bill with this package that the Senate will not have to take up and won't take up because it won't be attached to the other spending bills. It'll be a separate bill. So it'll give political cover to the Republicans who vote to fund Ukraine. It'll give them political cover by allowing them another vote on a border pretend weakened light border security bill that's not a must pass. It's because it's not attached to Ukraine. So the Senate will ignore it, just like they ignored H.R. 2 a year ago because we had no leverage to attach to it.
And I'm speaking with Representative Bob Good, who's the chair of the Freedom Caucus and out of the great state of Virginia. And you know, everything that you are articulating used to be Speaker Johnson's position before he became
That's
Speaker.
Right.
And I think
That's
that
right.
is what is just incredible to those. And I know Speaker Johnson personally. I mean, I know he is a man of faith. I know he is a conservative. I was very excited for him to become Speaker. And this is just baffling to me to see this difference and how he is basically running cover for the Democrats and is in a position that he's not just at least holding the line and holding Democrats' feet to the fire with the slimmest of majorities. So I was speaking with Representative Massey the other day, and his view was just that Speaker Johnson was absolutely unprepared for everything that has been thrown at him as Speaker, and maybe had the best of intentions, but just couldn't handle the job, basically. Do you think there's merit in that view?
Well, I don't know. And I try not to question his motives or to demean him as a person, so to speak. I focus on actions, and I'm going to attack the actions and criticize the actions. That's what I tried to do with the previous speaker. And there was a difference with the previous speaker. He'd been in leadership for some dozen years. He'd made a bunch of promises and commitments to become speaker. Speaker Johnson did not do that. And he didn't keep his word to us multiple times that he, again, the conditions he made to become speaker. And we don't, back then we had a 9-vote margin. Now we got like a 4-vote margin, getting ready to be a 3-vote margin. So the numbers are different. It's a more precarious situation. And those two individuals who said, hey, they think we ought to move forward a motion to vacate, I think we ought to have a contest in November. I don't think Speaker Johnson would have the necessary support to stay as speaker because he hasn't done anything to earn that, in my opinion. But I think that we probably should hold that contest in November after the election.
I would totally agree with you that it seems like if there was a motion to vacate the chair, we may end up with Speaker Hakeem Jeffries, which even though a lot of social media is saying, well, what's the difference? There is actually a big difference there. But I also really respect that distinction that you made, Representative Good, by saying, you know, that you will attack the policies and you'll criticize the policies, not the person. And I think too often when we are looking just and criticizing the policies and the actions, people assume that then that's an attack on the person. But those are very separate things, and we need to hold everyone accountable, whether they're a member of our own party or a member of the Democrat Party, even though, as we've already discussed, it seems like none of the Democrats can ever be accountable for any of their actions, which is monumentally frustrating. But last question for you before we have to wrap the segment, and I always appreciate your time. So if the Ukraine aid package is sent to the House floor, do you anticipate, even with a slim majority of Republicans, it will pass? Because we know that, I mean, there are a lot of Republicans, unfortunately, that do support Ukraine aid.
Yes, we're going to try to block the rule. We're going to make the speaker expose the fact that he's made a deal with Democrats, and Democrats are going to vote for the rule, and Democrats are going to vote overwhelmingly for the bill. We're not going to give Republican votes, that at least our Republican votes, to bad Democrat legislation, we believe, that's betrayed our principles on fiscal responsibility, paying for supplementals instead of borrowing, our principles on defending our own border, our principles that Israel aid shouldn't be tied to Ukraine aid because they're not related. And so, but I think the cake has been baked, the deal has been made, and the Democrats are going to provide as many votes as are needed to pass the rule, and then they'll overwhelmingly vote for the bill.
Well, we can only hope that that principles will intervene. But thank you so much, Representative Good. And please stay principled, fight the good fight. We respect you so much and are thankful that you are one of the few that is standing firm on conservative principles in Washington. We'll be right back with more. You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show, and that's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you, we need to save them. That's why we've partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears that heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies. And that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28, or $140, helps to rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just dial #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And, you know, I am just so personally disappointed in Speaker Johnson and would like some answers to the questions of why. And if you had asked me before he became Speaker and I had advocated for him to become Speaker, actually, who I most respected in Washington, I would have said Mike Johnson. So a lot of this just doesn't make sense. We need to continue praying for him, praying for his leadership and that he would make good and sound principled decisions. So please keep him and everyone in Washington in your prayers, regardless of party. But this then really begs the question, okay, with all of this frustration that we have, looking at the lack of accountability, the lack of fairness across the board, where do we go from here? And how should conservatives respond to this monumental failure of the rule of law versus political will? Steve Dace joined me on my Salem media show last night, and I want to play this full interview for you, and it's about 14 minutes long just because Steve Dace has amazing things to say. So listen to this.
I think it's a good embodiment, Jenna, of the larger rules of engagement that are taking place in our body politic. And I think we have to, let's go back to the very beginning. What is politics? All right. So the essence of politics is faith and ethics in action. All right. The idea, well, you can't legislate morality. That's actually the only thing you can actually legislate. Every piece of legislation is moral. It's just a matter of which morality we're legislating. So that's kind of the essence of politics. But in our country, the purpose of it is, it's how we conduct civil war in America. I mean, our founders gave us this process so we could, the casualties would be votes and issues and principles, not one another, that we would not have a banana republic where each week it's like, ooh, this general's tanks are rolling down Main Street. He's in charge now. And so they created this bureaucracy. They created this layered system, these multiple branches of government, with the intent of these arguments taking time so that you couldn't have wide passions sweep the country and take us in radical new directions with every single fad. And so these are the rules of engagement. This is how we do civil war in America. What's happened here, what's happened with Mayorkas is the latest example of it, is the social compact of America is broken. What is that? You know, in a marriage, there's a compact between the two of you, and then the act of getting married, that is ultimately what codifies that and turns it into a covenant, okay? Similarly, there is the Constitution codifies what the social compact is. It is, since we are together as a group of people, this is how we're going to live together now. The Democrats have completely abandoned this, Jenna. It's gone. And so, you know, we might makes right. Whoever has the gold, it gets to make the rules. Will to power, it's totally gone. And I think we are really struggling on the right with what to do in response to this. On one hand, we don't want to help them shred the Constitution. On the other hand, we can't ask ourselves to be bound to something that they're not being bound to. I mean, this is an unfaithful spouse, basically, in a marriage, you know, and we're going to have to figure this out. I don't have all the answers on this yet, but I think at the very least, we have to admit on the right, the social compact is broken, and therefore the rules of engagement and how we conduct civil war through the political process must change. We can't be over here, Jenna, saying, all right, we're going to follow the 75th codicil of the 93rd clause of the Geneva Convention while the enemy on the battlefield is lobbing mustard gas-laced grenades via nuclear warheads. That's not relevant. Doesn't mean I want to be a war criminal. Doesn't mean I want to abandon the traditions I'm trying to uphold, but it does mean I may have to expand my repertoire of what are the rules of engagement in response now to this new provocation.
And Steve, really well said, because what is then a proportional response, to use the war analogy? And then the question that follows, though, from your marriage covenant and breaking that analogy, is national divorce really the next mm-hmm. step, and what would that look like?
I don't think it's possible. I've got good friends of mine, from Daniel Horowitz, my colleague at The Blaze, to Jesse Kelly, that advocate this. I think, you know, let me use an analogy. I think that today's left, the spirit of the age, even though Jehovah's Witnesses traditionally are apolitical and don't get involved, they're Jehovah's Witnesses in terms of their political practice. These are people who, they want to knock on your door. You need to be fixed. You're wrong. You have to be changed. The idea they're going to say, all right, you tell you what, you guys take all the states with the balanced budgets and go to your own thing. No, that's never going to happen. I don't think that that's a possible solution. I think we can self-sort, and I'm a strong advocate of that. You know, if you look at the last election, for example, you know, if a couple million people that wasted their 7 million votes for Trump in California would have dispersed strategically in other parts of the country, we wouldn't be having some of these conversations right now. It's just one example. So I do think we can self-sort. What's happening with people flocking to a state like Florida is an example of this. But systemically, no, they're not going to let us go. The only way out is through. We're going to have to, this is a worldview steel cage match now, Jenna. Two worldviews have entered. Only one is going to leave. And the only way out is through. We're going to have to confront this and defeat it.
Yeah, so well said. This is a worldview issue, and you're absolutely right about morality dictating. And this is the problem with the left, that they have completely and utterly abandoned an objective standard of moral truth. And so they have this thin veneer of what they call justice, and yet they're manipulating that into a new definition. And we saw this not just with Mayorkas, but also at the Supreme mm-hmm. Court yesterday, with the DOJ trying to manipulate this completely out of context statute just to go after the January 6th
defendants when Justice Gorsuch plainly asked the Solicitor General, why haven't you applied this to BLM riots with a Kavanaugh's own confirmation hearings, all of these other examples of violent protests? And the Solicitor General manipulated herself into a pretzel instead of just answering substantively and directly, because we want to. That's all that it is that they want to have the new standard be whatever we want to do, we will have happen, and we will make a political outcome and call it justice. So we can't possibly continue to exist in a society that manipulates the political outcome and calls it justice.
Well, since we're sitting here on Salem and it's the largest Christian media company in on this hemisphere, let's look at this through an explicitly Christian lens. Okay. What's going to be a major difference? We are now in a post-Christian era. We are in a pagan country. And this is going to be new for Christians in the West, and specifically in this country. This is the only country in the history of Christendom that was uniquely founded and inspired by Christian principles, the only one. But if you look at prior to the pilgrims at Plymouth Rock, pretty much the previous 1600 years of Christian history was that those who truly wanted to live and follow the Bible were not the hegemony. They were the minority. They were persecuted, and they had to still learn that they had to live that out. They were still called to walk that narrow road, even under persecution. And even the pilgrims themselves, Jenna, they weren't even fleeing Catholics. They were fleeing other Protestants. The Anglican King of England saying, I'll teach you what you can preach and what parts of the Bible you can use. And so this has actually been the history of Christianity from the very beginning. The tireless minority changing things from the inside out through things like civil disobedience, living faithfully despite what the spirit of the age.
And we got to take a hard break right here, but we'll get back to more of this lesson and where we should go as Americans and as conservatives when we get right back. Continuing my conversation with Steve Dace, who is the host of the Steve Dace Show at Blaze TV. And Steve, you're in the middle of articulating very well what has always been Christians combating this ridiculous, untruthful worldview, because there's truth and there's everything else. So where do we go from here?
We got to use the playbook of the large cloud of witnesses that came before us, Jenna. I mean, how did Christianity survive against Nero? How did it survive against Saladin and Islam? How did it survive all of these years? Well, at a metaphysical sense, it survives because we represent the only true living God. And upon this rock he has built his church. Not even the gates of hell will prevail against it. So that's what it means at a meta level. But at a practical, earthly, natural level, what does that look like? Inspired by that, believers have been willing to suffer for what they believe. The gladiator games in Rome were canceled because one monk, Telemachus, came out of the stands and demanded they stop the slaughter. He was murdered right there on the floor of the Colosseum for doing that. But that murder so abhorred Rome that was the last day the gladiator games ever took place. So a willingness to suffer for what we believe in. Civil disobedience, you think of the civil rights movement, largely sparked because a 29-year-old Baptist seamstress got on a bus one day and just uttered the word no. A refusal to go with and obey unjust laws, like everyone from Augustine to Aquinas and many of Christendom's great patriarchs were unwilling to do. John Bunyan spent almost 20 years in a prison for refusing to follow the law, what the King of the England decided was the law when it was an unlaw. So these are things that are going to be new to us. We're going to look around this culture. We're going to see relics of a history and a legacy that is largely a whitewashed tomb and not really true. And the temptation will be to just call upon those legacies as if they will organically do what they were instilled to do. No, we're not a nation of laws, and we never have been. We're a nation of political will, and we always will be. Those institutions that bear marks of our faith were founded from men who pledged their lives, fortunes, and sacred honors to establish them, and they paid those prices. So this idea we're going to restore them or preserve them without any discomfort is not true. We're going to have to be willing to suffer. We're going to have to be willing to sacrifice. We're going to have to be willing to say no. I mean, Christians need to learn the word no again. That's a magical word. Learn to say the word no. Just say no sometimes, even when you mean yes, just to get used to saying no. All right? We're going to refuse. We're not going to go along with things. I'm not going to keep quiet anymore. Okay? And you know, it's kind of funny. You know, Jesus once said, the children of men are smarter than the children of light. What I'm describing are actually many of the cultural tactics that the left in the spirit of the age have used to gain the advantage they have today. They basically took our own playbook and said, hey, you guys want to hide out in the suburbs and watch Tiger King? We'll take your principles and we'll use them against you. And that's exactly one of the reasons we're right here where we are now.
So well said. And this is inherently a theological discussion because we are discussing the difference between truth versus falsity. And in the biblical worldview, and the only truth that we understand from the reality to which we're presented, as C.S. Lewis said, is that truth is a person. And when we grow in the grace and knowledge of the person of truth, we stand up for truth and we turn away from wickedness and evil and everything that is false. So there is a distinction, Steve, even though you rightly say that we're a nation of political will, not just a nation of rules, because sometimes the rules can be evil too, anyway. But that political will can't just be focused on a man or a political party. And I think that's where the conservative new right is heading. They're right in, or correct, I should say, in wanting to stand up against tyranny and wanting to stand up for something. But the something has to be truth, not just wherever the populace and the heads of the party, and of course, I mean Donald Trump, are trying to lead them, because he can be wrong. We have to firmly stand on truth.
I mean, last week, Donald Trump tweeted, FISA has to be ended. For people that don't know, that is the warrantless surveillance program that was used to spy on Trump and his campaign in 2016. So he didn't tweet it because he was on Twitter. He put that on Truth Social. 48 hours later, he does a press conference with Mike Johnson at Mar-a-Lago. He says, I'm no fan of it, but do what you want. This is the very program that was the instrument to launch the entire Russian collusion fallacy we all suffered under for 3 years, that essentially was a de facto coup against his presidency. And he's like, yeah, do what you want. And hey, Mike Johnson's my boy. This is the danger of putting all your eggs in one man's basket, any man's basket. Okay. And so I wholeheartedly agree with you on this. The problem is that we want to do this because that gives us another excuse to be passive. Trump will save us. Trump will take care of it. I voted Republican. I watched Fox News again. Lindsey Graham got to the bottom of it with Sean Hannity again tonight. Okay. We're still reading Mark Rich's emails. It gives me an excuse to not have to worry about getting my hands dirty, to not have to go to a school board meeting, to not have to tick anybody off at Thanksgiving while Aunt Petunia is basically reading Rules for Radicals as the pre-meal prayer. This, we are seeking passivity. We crave it. Show me a reason why I don't have to do a darned thing, and I'll likely take that path of least resistance.
And isn't that always the way of man? And that clashes completely with Ephesians 5 that says, take advantage of every opportunity because the days are evil. And I think that message is entirely apt and has been for the entire New Testament age, which is the last days that we are still living in. And so just in the last about minute and a half we have with you, Steve, and I so appreciate that you bring this back to a truthful standard, not just politics. How can we, in practical terms, stand up and take advantage of every opportunity? Like I think you and I do. And in all honesty, I'm so grateful for you not worrying about your audience, your following, you know, the grift or, you know, MAGA approval or any of that nonsense, just simply standing up and speaking truth.
I think it starts with a very simple challenge we all have to answer. If Baal or the spirit of the age is Lord, go and serve that. Don't be in the in-between. Go and serve that. Cash the check. If the Lord is Lord, serve him, okay? Choose ye this day whom you will serve. It really starts there. And that challenge needs to emanate from our pulpits, all right? It needs to emanate from dads in the home to the family. That needs to be modeled by those pastors echoing that that are giving that challenge and those fathers that are issuing that challenge. That's where it starts. That's where it's always started. And from there, that mustard seed can grow, Jenna. One plants, another waters, and then God will give the increase.
Amen. And to be lukewarm, the Bible says, I will spew you out of my mouth. It is better to be cold than lukewarm. So, Steve, I always so appreciate you. Thank you again for your stand for truth. And this is why I care about standing for truth. I don't care about my following or the haters. I care about standing for truth because truth matters.
And that was my interview with Steve Dace on the Salem side. So you can always watch that at salemnewschannel.com. We stream it on X, anywhere that podcasts are as well. But he's so right. And we have to, as Christians, put on the full armor of God daily. Be strong in the Lord and his mighty power. Don't think a political party or even a great document like the U.S. Constitution will save you from the perils and the evils and the sin of this world. We have to be strong in the Lord and his mighty power. Put on the full armor of God so that you may take your stand against the devil's schemes, and at the end, you will stand firm. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.